Hey folks, Fred DeLore here, welcoming you to another episode of On Background, your premier podcast for diving deep into the stories behind the headlines and exploring the intricate world of politics beyond the polls. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you won't miss out on any of our episodes. We're constantly bringing you fresh and unique behind-the-scenes insights with some incredible guests. And trust me, if you're a political junkie like I am, these are conversations you won't want to miss. This week, I want to get into the weeds a bit on parliamentary procedure, where the real politics takes place. Or at least I thought so as a kid when I first fell in love with politics while watching CPAC after school. I find it a fascinating topic though, and something I want to learn more about, so I'm excited to have with us someone who's made it her mission to decode the labyrinth of Canadian parliamentary politics process and procedure. Katie O'Malley is not just a journalist. She's a nearly lifelong resident of the capital with an enviable resume that spans the Hill Times, Maclean's Magazine, CBC News, Post Media, and is now writing for iPolitics. Beyond her written work, Katie is a familiar voice on political panels and a frequent guest across CBC Radio nationwide. Katie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You and I used to chat a lot when I was director of communications for the Conservative Party many moons ago, but I don't think we probably haven't talked in well over a decade.
No, that was quite a real era that we passed by.
The Harper era,
you're the
right?
Only one who liked us.
I was doing like
you're literally the only one who liked
it's
us.
Funny. I think that may still be the. It's probably some things don't change. But look, I don't want to sound mean here when I say this, but you are a self-proclaimed process nerd.
Hugely.
Right?
Absolutely. You know, just lock me up if that's a crime. I do find it fascinating. It's kind of the same way as you. When you're watching the House of Commons, there is, you know, question period is obviously like the main event. That's what people tune in for. But
right.
There are so many other things that happen. And what kind of got me into it was, well, first of all, I was in a job that actually, much like I do right now, I had to be able to predict what was going to happen a couple of days ahead of time. So I had to understand how the House operated outside of that 45-minute block. And that, of course, required me to, you know, talk to House Leader's Office and learn about things like, you know, like hoist motions and how do supply days work and all of these things. And it all sort of synthesized. And then in a majority, I mean, yeah, sometimes they do. They become an issue. Something will happen and they actually do affect what happens in the House of Commons. But in minority, I mean, all bets are off because that is where opposition parties particularly are able to use procedure to as a leverage and a way to kind of get the agenda on something they want to see. And I think that that was one reason that kind of hooked me. And ever since then, and again, a lot of people don't realize how the rules work and things will take them by surprise. But if you know the codes and you know sort of the signs to watch for, you can, it's like tracking weather. You can kind of predict when something's going to turn into an issue by what happens ahead of time. So yeah, I just found it made my life easier if I could predict the future and proceed and parliamentary procedure and knowing the rules helped me do that.
It's fascinating you say this. You're really opening my eyes to thinking about how much media covers, you know, the parliamentary press gallery is the name of the institution that covers the parliament here. But I don't know many people that actually cover parliament the way you just described it. It's usually
people's eyes glaze over.
Right.
They really do.
They cover the government and the opposition in terms of the announcements they're making, but not necessarily what's navigating through the House. You said something there that caught my attention right out of the gate. You said hoist motion. Mm-hmm. What is that?
So hoist motion, that's one of the few motions or amendments you can bring at second reading, which is generally speaking, you know, not to do the whole how a bill becomes a law. But second reading is the debate on approval of principles. So basically MPs will discuss the goal of a bill or a piece of legislation before sending it to committee, which is where they get into the technical details and where the actual amending happens, except for hoist motions. Hoist motions, you can do a 6-month hoist, I think you can do a 12-month hoist and a 3-month hoist. What it is it's an amendment that says, instead of sending this to committee, we're going to put it on hold for 6 months because, I don't know, the government is corrupt or whatever. You can have any reason for doing it. But what it does is it adds time to the clock. It means that if the government's kind of in a hurry to get that bill to that second reading vote, which we know can absolutely happen, they have to figure out how to maneuver around the hoist motion. And that is a good example of one way that opposition parties can sort of start laying down the groundwork to make their job of opposing a piece of legislation more effective from their perspective. Because I mean, at least in theory, if you're an opposition party and you are opposing what the government does, you do want to obstruct legislation because you don't think it's good legislation and you don't think it should be passed. So here is a way that you can add a little time to the clock and you can slow it down. And a lot of what turns into these sort of procedural battles is over that basic clash between opposition and government over who controls the clock and who controls the progress of a piece of legislation.
How often do we see this, a hoist motion?
They come in waves. They were in style for a while, actually under the Chrétien era, which is how I, not to age myself here, but that's how I first learned about them because opposition parties would bring them then. There's now...
And that was majority of the whole time,
it
too,
was
right?
Majority, but you can bring... This is the wonders of procedure, not to turn into a real parliamentary zealot here, but even in a majority, even if ultimately the government knows that it can win something when it comes to a vote, there are still ways for an opposition party to hold things up and to delay. And again, that is actually kind of their job. So hoist
that's
motion,
having worked in opposition and in government, but in opposition, our job, the way we've always looked at it, is just, even if it's good legislation,
it's
the mentality is that, well, it's the other side, so stop it. Do whatever you can to stop it.
Yeah, and I mean, personally, we can get into this after. I think there are ways to be more strategic about it than perhaps how some opposition parties go about doing it, but that is absolutely the goal, and this is another way of doing it. It's a little less effective if the government is able to bring in time allocation. Well, we all know what time allocation motions are basically saying, okay, you've had your fun at second reading. We're going to give this one more day and then we're calling the vote. And that would mean every question would be put, so that would deal with the hoist motion as well. But it's just a way to add a little bit of time under the clock, but it becomes cumulative. If you put up enough stuff like that, you can add 3, 4, 5 days to each stage, and that can make life difficult for the government. And we've seen that. And this is a government that, when the Liberals first came in as majority, they had this whole thing where they didn't want to use time allocation, and they actually didn't much. Like, they really
because the Harper government did a lot.
They did it a lot,
and
the Liberals were like, let's all get along and pass laws. And I mean, I do believe that that's what they wanted to do.
Right. But, and then they got bogged down and couldn't get
through. Well, yeah, they couldn't actually pass laws because even with a majority, there are so many ways that motions to concurring committee reports, a new absolute favorite of the Conservatives.
See that a lot now, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a very effective way of tying up anywhere from an hour to 3 hours of debate, depending on how you play it. Like, if you really want to make it a thing, you start the concurrence debate, you then move that another member be heard, you can force vote after vote after vote. The government can, when they finally get on their feet, say, okay, enough of this nonsense, we move to adjourn debate, but that's still a 30-minute bell on a vote. So a big chunk of government time that would have otherwise gone to legislation has been used up. You do that every day, it's incredibly annoying to the government, and it's very low effort for the opposition.
Right. You just have to call votes on committee reports, which really mean nothing.
And they've actually gotten really clever about this, because they're not just moving to concur in the reports. They're now suggesting they add stuff.
Right.
So say it's a report on, from the Agriculture Committee on, like, how farms are great. Well, why don't we suggest that the committee add a part about how the carbon tax is bad? Shall we do that? And then
you
debate that, so you get your little message in there as well.
Right.
I have to say the Conservatives have really turned the concurrence motion into an art form.
And it's just it's under Poilievre's leadership, right, that they seem to be doing that? They weren't doing that. I know.
They did concurrence motions, but not to the same extent, and they weren't getting that sophisticated about it.
Right.
So, yeah, whoever he's got in his team, he's got someone who understands how best to sort of pull those levers and knows how to kind of take advantage of that power.
My sense is it's Andrew Scheer, right, former Speaker of the House. He's House Leader
yeah,
now.
Yeah, he would be someone. And as Speaker, he probably had to shut down, the occasional concurrence debate as well.
But he seems to be a real procedural wonk himself.
He is absolutely. And he is also, he prefers the traditional standing up and raising points of privilege or points of order, which also, of course, have to be aired out. All of it is, the goal is, there are certain, on any given parliamentary day, there are certain times that if you hit them, the government can't, you can keep going. If you can keep the debate going till 5:30, private member business start. Private members business is one of the few things in the entire parliamentary universe that cannot be disrupted.
Fascinating.
Here's another trick. Whenever there's a rule in parliament, you're like, I wonder why that became a thing. You can pretty much assume that an unintended consequence led to complete chaos breaking out in the House of Commons, and they had to bring in a rule to stop it from ever happening again. So with private members, this is why there's all these protocols that are in place, basically to protect private members. So at no point can a government derail it. At no point can the parties sort of conspire to keep something off the list. Like, everything is handled on its own separate track. Because, you know, it's important. It's a 1 hour that actually belongs to MPs and not to the government. So right. You gotta keep it safe.
Right, and you gotta keep the backbench happy on both sides.
Yeah.
And if they're having their time
they
interrupted.
Enjoy their things. You know, they do. They have
I'm
fun.
Sure, they, yeah, important legislation they want to get passed for their constituents.
It's actually kind of fun because you can always tell when a bill is, like, actually something that an MP, like, has, you know, for the last 20 years been hoping to bring this forward. Like, it's their pet project.
Right.
Versus something that the leader's office is like, you've got a high spot in the lottery. Here's the bill I think you want to bring forward. So, yeah, you can usually kind of tell the difference between them. But, yes.
So the Conservatives have been very effective of late doing this with the concurrence motions. There's been two instances in the last year, in the last 12 months, where Poilievre has come out and basically announced filibusters of sorts, right? There was last spring where he said he was going to filibuster. I can't remember the exact what the issue was. And he got up and it made it the media story. And what he got out there was that he was going to talk for weeks on end.
Yeah. I think he did not.
He talked for a few hours, right?
It was very disappointing.
It was fascinating. Like, what happened there? Yeah. Do you recall?
Okay, here's the other fun thing about the parliamentary calendar. There are these particular deadlines. They are when the estimates have to be passed by. There's one in December. There's one usually in March, and then there's another one in June. And there's another one in December. They're usually right before the House is supposed to break.
Right.
Now, those estimates, like, they have to pass. Government can't function, right?
It's almost like the U.S. where they shut down government.
It's going to be like marathon votes if it has to. So, yeah, the Conservatives have, you know, like a week or two before an estimates vote is going to come, because everyone knows when they're going to come. They're just on the calendar.
Right.
They will kind of start to lay the groundwork for a filibuster. Now, strategically, I feel like the Conservatives kind of lost a bit of the thread simply because, if I recall correctly, the summer filibuster, which was leading to June, Poilievre's line was something like, you know, and we want to keep the House sitting all summer to rewrite the budget. Well, no, that's not going to happen. Now, if you're a little bit more strategic, you might be able to use that as leverage and get the government to give something they'll actually give you.
Yeah, but they didn't want to be given anything.
They just wanted the story that they're shutting down government. They were going to shut down. I think it ended 2 days before the scheduled date. Like, it kind of drives me crazy because it is an absolutely legitimate tactic to use. There are just more efficient ways of doing it. Like, if you go for something like get another two opposition days, get the government to agree to a special.
But you're thinking they want something from the government. They don't want anything.
They want good coverage and good clips
that they can use.
Yes.
Showing it to their people. Like, look, we tried. We wanted to keep them here all summer
to rewrite the budget.
Those lazy liberals wanted to leave town and have summer vacation. We wanted to keep working all summer.
Yeah, that was the message they tried, and that's what worked.
And that, like, I remember when he had tremendous stories coming
out.
Although
when he tried it the second time, journalists were like, wait. Didn't you say this last time?
Right. So in December, he did it again, right? Where he said, we're going to keep everyone through Christmas.
Another estimates vote.
Right. And I think they added, did they add any, when you look at the grand scale?
They had a few little new tricks. They had a whole bunch of amendments that they put, like 10,000 amendments generated by AI at the Natural Resources Committee, which was going to hold up the Green Transition Bill. And then we're in the House of Commons, where you're fairly limited as far as the amendments you can put forward at report stage, at least in the House of Commons. The Senate is its own total different story. But you can basically propose to delete a clause, and you can propose to change a clause. But it's very technical. But they were still able to come up with something like, I think there are over 100, maybe even 200 amendments. In theory, that could have forced like a week-long vote.
Right.
But what the government did is they took a look at those amendments. They took a look at the calendar. They thought about the Green Transition Bill, and they thought, you know what? This can wait till January.
They pulled the bill.
Yeah. No, they just didn't. They just didn't bother calling it. It's still there.
I didn't realize that.
They just didn't call it.
Fascinating. But there was late night voting, though, in December.
There was. I think there was maybe a little over 24 hours, like 26 hours they went. Yeah, because with the that's right. Because with the estimates, the Conservatives demanded a recorded vote on every line item. Everyone had to be a roll call. You couldn't apply. I mean, if you apply votes, that basically everyone says, hi, my party votes the same way as they did last time. So you can go through a lot of votes in a very short time. They didn't allow that. So everyone was a standing vote. But they did eventually run out of estimates. And I think the one downside there is that the Liberals can now say absolutely accurately things like, But this was the party that voted against money for firefighters because there was an that actual was specific
that,
line
so
item.
Many, so many, yeah.
There was a specific line item that was money for firefighters right. that because they voted against everything.
Voting against the budget is one thing.
Voting
but when you
against
break it
specific,
out.
And that is, but that's the only way you can prolong it. But yeah, and I think at this point we almost expect that at the end of a sitting, there's going to be probably either a late night vote or a late night into the next morning.
Right, there always has been. I remember all the
time. It is pretty traditional.
Like, remember under when Harper was in government, the NDP doing those
yes.
those slow votes too.
Slow
did,
voting,
right?
Where good old slow voting.
Every MP rises very. That was the only time I've ever seen that. Was Mulcair leader then? I assume.
I think he was. Yeah,
where they
just
got up super slow to vote.
Yeah, you can delay it for like 30 minutes.
They're so.
But
ridiculous.
they've got a new trick now with the hybrid voting. They can suddenly have, you know, a terrible epidemic where suddenly no one's, you know, was able to register their vote, so they need to appear on video and vote by, you know.
Oh, you can do that.
Yes, you can. And actually, if you look at some of the final votes towards Christmas, there are a whole lot of conservatives whose voting apps were mysteriously not working, so they had to go on the webcam and.
So I see that once in a while. You'll see one MP
after
a vote.
Sometimes it's
legitimate,
but sometimes
it's
like, hey, wait a second, how is your entire
party? Why is it all one party all over the country?
Exactly.
Having the same technical issue.
But yeah, and that can add a bit of time. So yeah, I mean, honestly, it really is about every minute you can take up that would otherwise go to government business is a score.
Right.
That's, you know, that makes the life more difficult for the government, and as a result, you are doing your job as an opposition.
Right. What other procedural tricks do you see that the government can use? Obviously, they have time allocation.
So yeah, now that they've come to terms with the notion that they are going to have to, but again, in a minority, time allocation not a guarantee.
Right.
You actually do right. need at least one other party to support you, which means you need, first of all, a party that supports whatever you're trying to speed
and believes up, and believes you should get it
and
through
is
quick.
Willing to do it quickly. So yeah, you can't and some parties are really leery about it. They don't love voting for time allocation motions, so it's something you have to use sparingly. Yeah, actually, I think Carina Gould's trick with the Just Transition bill, where she was just like, you know what, I'm not going to call that bill. I'm just going to leave that one to simmer for a bit. I'm going to focus on something else. That's one thing they can do is change their own agenda and decide, okay, here is the battle we're willing to pick because we've got limited time left. I mean, I do think this government has now come to terms with the fact that they're not going to pass everything they want. They're probably not even going to be able to get to pass most of the things they want. They need to pick the key items that they actually want to focus the resources on. And if that means like 4 or 5 bills, well,
that's fascinating given I know it's a minority, but it's a de facto majority and there's a year and a half to go. And you're saying they still
They have to be real. Well, the New Democrats, remember, the supply and confidence deal does, it does oblige the New Democrats to support the Liberals on anything that's an explicit confidence matter. So a budget vote, anything that is designated as such.
Right.
But the way the language is, there's a little bit of language about how since both parties want things to move through the House quickly, we may cooperate. It's very coded language. But what it means is, hey, we might ask you guys to like vote to shut down a filibuster at committee, and we would love it if you do it. But it's not a deal, like no pun intended, a deal breaker if you don't. So yeah,
right.
The Liberals have to be careful what they're going to ask the NDP to do. They do have the advantage of they can also ask the Bloc. They're not in a deal with them, but the Bloc Québécois is sometimes absolutely willing to, you know, just shut down nonsense that they see and
yeah.
side with the government to get something through. Committee is another place where procedure can get very wild and woolly. Filibusters are much easier to launch there.
So that's one of my very
yeah.
few experiences in parliamentary procedure was working in committee back mm-hmm. when the Harper...
Which committee?
Immigration. When Harper first became prime minister, I worked for Dianne Findlay when she's minister of immigration. And there was I can't remember, it was the Refugee Appeal Division, I think. Mm-hmm. It was a part of the Immigration Act that was not yet, the Liberals had passed the bill years ago when they were in government, never put it into force and didn't want to because
right.
apparently it was flawed legislation or something was wrong with it. So when they were in government, they weren't going to trigger mm-hmm. it. We formed government and now the Liberal opposition was like, yeah, we got to get this in right away. So they were pushing to do it, and we were of the opinion it should not go in yet. Again, I think it just needed to be fixed. I don't even know if it ever made it through. But we did a filibuster at committee, and I remember going to the House Leader's office, the Whip's office, prime minister's off talking to everyone. How do we do a filibuster? Like, I don't know what, like I was told, like, don't let this pass committee. And I was like, okay, on it. Talking to everyone I could talk to. No one could give me.
I wish I had. Many ideas.
But I had like basically the only advice I got was just talk. Have someone talk very slowly. Like, yeah. Okay.
And that's slow talking can work. The trick at committee is if you're the opposition and you want to launch a filibuster, you would ideally have an opposition chair. And as you know, there's only four committees that are chaired by opposition members. There's ethics, government ops. Status of women, for some reason, has never made a lot of sense to me. And what is the other one? It's the other public accounts, of course.
Right.
Those are the three oversight committees and status of women, for some reason, no one's ever actually been able to explain. There you've got a chair because of the what you might run into at another committee that is not chaired by a friendly person who might give you the liberty to speak as long as you want. There is a rule, a fun rule called repetition and relevance. And if a member decides to raise a point of order at committee that someone's speech is either A, wildly irrelevant, or B, repeating things that have already been said, the chair can, very rare that they do this, but they can actually call a vote even when there are still speakers left on the list.
Right.
Because other than that, other than those very exceptional circumstances, the rule at committee is as long as there are people that want to talk, the debate continues. There's no timeline. So if you can talk at the clock for 2 hours, that's the meeting.
Right.
And if you can do that.
That's what we did. Yeah. We were able to talk it through and it came up several times. And then the summer session happened. And then I got sucked in the prime minister's office and have no idea what happened.
Who knows what happened? I'm sure, you know, it probably lived happily ever after.
It may also have been eventually approved. I don't know. Back to the motion of no confidence. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when that's triggered, it's a big deal because it's not. We could go to the polls at any time. So the Liberals don't seem. They did it a few. No, they didn't do it in the fall because it was all budget. It was all estimates, right?
Every estimates vote is technically a confidence motion.
Right.
Anything that's about the spending of government money, if the House of Commons says we don't trust you to spend the money, that's basically saying, and we don't trust you to, you know, remain in office. Please clear out. We're going to the polls. Like
right.
That is, you know, those are all automatically considered confidence matters. I think the Liberals are less worried about it right now. Well, I mean, to be honest, at a certain point, worrying doesn't help. Like, if you're in a minority government,
Yeah. You've
got your supply and confidence deal. You really hope that you're going to be able to count on either the New Democrats or, in a pinch, there is the Bloc Québécois.
I remember, I think it was when Harper's first minority, I think we needed two opposition parties to support us.
That sounds, yeah.
Which was tough. Or one that had to abstain, which was a thing that was happening back then, too.
Oh, the Liberals did that for, like, you remember they did months? The NDP baked them a cake. I will never forget this. The NDP baked them a cake because the Liberals, this is when they were in leadership between either Dion? No, it must have been under Ignatieff. And they, for some reason, they didn't want to bring down the government, but they also didn't want to vote for legislation, so they kept abstaining.
Right.
And the New Democrats baked them a cake to mark the 100th abstention vote.
Right.
And that was, you know, I think a rather humiliating low for many, many Liberal MPs.
In the Harper opposition, we did vote once, we did abstain on a budget.
Or, did you really?
Against Martin, yes. We weren't entirely sure where we were, and then we decided we wanted to go to the polls, and then we spent the next 2 years trying to bring them down.
Technically, when you're the official opposition, you are supposed to oppose.
Right.
Like, if you're the third or the fourth party, you might have wiggle room, even like majority or minority, like you might be able to kind of finesse it. But when you're the official opposition, you kind of have to oppose. That's just sort of the thing.
There was that famous story, right, when Bob Stanfield was conservative leader and they voted no confidence or they voted against a liberal confidence motion, I guess a budget item, and the Liberals failed, and we were about to go to the polls, right? Until they decided, let's have a redo. Like, that was a fascinating.
Sometimes cooler heads prevail.
How does that even, I don't understand, like, the vote happened.
Yeah, we haven't,
counted.
We haven't had something like, well.
They all just agree, so we just don't know.
Well,
the
House of Commons is, something like that couldn't happen unless you were able to get a critical mass of MPs on both sides to agree that, okay, the House of Commons is master of its own destiny. Maybe the House of Commons wants to reconsider its position. It's always got to be collective, though.
Right.
Because, you know, sometimes in the light of day, bringing down the government doesn't always seem like the best idea. We've also had governments try to claim that things aren't confidence declarations.
When they clearly should be.
They really obviously are.
And then, yeah, then it's just up to interpretation from the government.
Yeah, and I can't even imagine how frustrating that would be for an opposition party, to be honest. Like, you actually bring down the government. They're like, no, we don't really recognize
that. Well, do you remember during the Harper, when they were ready to take them down, I believe the Bloc and the NDP were all aligned at some level. Every day after question period, Harper would raise and raise a motion to end the business of the day. And they would do that. There was squabbling over the budget. They were all against the budget until the Liberals made a deal with the NDP to create the NDP Liberal budget of 05. So that we were seeing that then. They kept shutting down Parliament every day. The opposition parties were and calling it a confidence vote.
This is I think the other challenge that people don't always realize with even in a minority, and the Conservatives are realizing this. I mean, they've obviously realized this now. In this case, you need all of the opposition parties to support something to override the votes of the government. And that is sometimes hard to get. And you have to
be very... We have three very different parties.
You do. And there are some things where you can... Opposition. Like, We Charity being a perfect example, where you actually did have... All three of the opposition parties were very keen to keep digging into this, despite the government being absolutely horrified at the notion. That is rarer than you'd think. And I think the Conservatives have occasionally run into situations where... They kind of take for granted that the other parties are going to support them. And then when they don't, particularly at committee, it kind of throws their strategy up. Oh, but before I forget, one thing I just wanted to say, and this actually came up during the Harper years, during the Harper minority, the second one. Committees were, of course, you know, where action happened. And even the Liberals, who at that time did not want to bring down the government, they were pretty okay voting to basically to override the Conservatives at committee. Right up until the day the Conservatives kind of let it be known that they would start to take votes at committee as tacit declarations of non-confidence. Now, they could do this because the Conservatives weren't afraid to go to an election. The Liberals very much did not want to. So you suddenly saw
we weren't afraid to. We didn't want to, but we weren't afraid.
No, you weren't afraid, and you were willing to say, okay, you guys have had a lot of fun at committee, but if we see a vote that we think shows that you do not have that there is not a confidence there, we are going to take it as such. And boy, did that shut the Liberals down. Like, they were not holding up budgets anymore. They were not proposing amendments.
So it worked.
Oh, yeah, it worked really well. Huh. Now, it worked because the Liberals didn't want it. Like, it was a
situation. Yeah, you pushed them and they put their hands
really,
up.
Said, I'm trying to, why did they not want an election so badly? It was a terrible state for them. They were like a year and a half.
They were in rough shape after they lost government, right? They got Dion.
It was under Ignatieff.
Right, but that Dion, and then they had his 2 years, and then Ignatieff came in, and they were up and down with Ignatieff, right? They wanted an election, and then they would talk tough, and then they would cave. They were all over the place.
They were just completely chaotic. But yeah, it was an extremely... And the other very, very effective thing the Conservatives did when they were in opposition was... Omnibudgets.
And that makes sense when you're in a minority parliament, and that's almost looking to the future. If we look at the polls, Polyev's getting a very large, maybe a historically large majority government, but campaigns matter and we'll see what happens. Let's say it's a minority government. He may have to, we may be going back to omnibudgets where it's every legislation.
You got to put everything. In. And, you know, a gentleman named Ali Kanvelshi, I remember him sitting down and he was, you know, did your time cross a PM?
One of the smartest guys in politics.
He's so smart. He taught me a lot of stuff about procedure too, just in terms of, you know, and he was just a genius at spotting. And he loved, I mean, quite reasonably, he loved the omnibudget because especially with the Liberals afraid that any delay to the omnibudget would be seen as a confidence move, they were paralyzed. There was nothing they could do. And it was an extremely, now that was a very unique circumstance because you don't ordinarily have an opposition party that is that reluctant to bring down a government, but it worked great for them at the time.
And that's the thing with the Conservatives, we could never be reluctant because our base, our supporters always want us to go to take out the Liberals, to take out the governing party if it's them. And the Liberals don't have that, right? They like it's about more strategy, like what's the right time to do this?
Yes.
Which helps us.
Well, also, as you say, they were in meltdown mode. Like they didn't really know what they were doing. They had no structure. They were not in a great position.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, but it's something that the Conservatives, if they do, you know, if they end up in a majority, great. All this is irrelevant to them. If they end up in a minority, they're going to have to figure out ways to, first of all, work with the parties that are there and in the dynamics. And kind of a worst case scenario for them would be if they need two out of the three parties to support them to get anything done.
Right.
Because that'd be rough.
That also means there's a colossal failure in the campaign and something's wrong and there's going to be problems, right? Based on where we are in the poll. Like, you need two parties?
But anything can happen. You know worst case, politics are.
Absolutely. Look, anything could happen. Trudeau's been behind three elections in a row and has come back to win. So
I always remember back in 2015 where it was like, I think we the media, we had the Liberals losing that campaign like weekly. Every week was like, well, he said he's going to run deficits. There goes any hope the Liberals ever had.
Yeah,
then, oh, the debates are going to happen. He's just going to be crushed. Will the Liberals, maintain official party status?
And they were in third place during that campaign.
They were.
Right?
And they just, they just didn't pay attention to the rest of us and they just sort of crawled on up.
It certainly feels different today.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen a lead this big for any party.
Oh, it is massive and he's got the party, probably ever has the party support. Which is really crucial. You are not, and of course, those two kind of go in tandem. If you're doing real well,
they
on the
certainly
polls,
do. If you're up
no
20,
one's going to say
everyone's in line.
Yeah, but I mean, who knows? 6 months from now, like things can change. I'm not saying that he, but we could see it shrink to 10 points, which is still a lead, still a good lead,
and still the biggest that I have ever seen.
still impressive. But where is it? Also, is it like all in Alberta? Because that's less helpful.
Yeah, that's always the thing when we go up. We've won the last two elections in terms of popular vote, but he's winning in every demographic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, his numbers now are like perfect.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a time
it's such a perfect storm it's change election, Trudeau's going for his fourth mandate, the inflation and
sea
affordability.
Of troubles laughing at our
shores. And I say all those things that have nothing to do with Poilievre, but then there's Poilievre, who is running a very good campaign and he is in campaign mode. He is out there. He's very aggressive. Obviously, there could be criticism here and there on his style, but the guy is everywhere. He's flying around at a different level I've never seen.
My only question, I totally agree with everything you just said, and this is my question is, let's say there isn't an election this fall. Can you maintain that momentum for a year, particularly when a lot of the message is like apocalyptic horror? Housing hell. Like, how long can you tell Canadians they are living in hell before they're like, you know what? You've been saying this for 6 months. It's pretty bad, but it's not hell. So can you keep that?
Well,
but I
think the counter argument is a lot of people feel it is.
Yeah, like, but will
like
they in 6
hell
months?
Hell is a strong word.
Will they in 6 months, though?
Well, I don't think inflation's coming down in 6 months to the level it is. Like, I know personally for me, my mortgage has doubled.
Yeah, I mean, if interest rates fall, a lot of people have sort of pointed out, if interest rates were even to fall like 2 points, that starts
and even,
to change
and
things.
Let's say it comes right down to where it was, we still went through this period.
Yeah, and people, that's true. Like, but do people have memories?
I don't know. That's a very good question on what people remember and how long that goes.
I just think right now, if we had an election right now, Poilievre would probably win the largest majority, at least the Conservatives have ever seen and possibly, you've ever seen in Canada.
Yeah, they've won. The two biggest majorities were Diefenbaker and Mulroney every 40 or 50 years.
In 8 months, I don't know. Just because things can change so quickly. And I do wonder if presenting it as this dramatic, sudden, we're going to fall off the cliff, your cars are going to be sold. Like, it's the kind of message, actually, we're so off the parliamentary procedure right now. I'm sure they're going to
look, we're sitting around having a drink, talking on background. We can talk whatever we want to talk about.
Here is the thing. Bring it home. This is the line. This is the slogan. To me, that is the slogan and the message you bring out in the last 3 weeks of the campaign. Because you've come this far, bring it home.
Right.
I just don't know if you can keep telling people to bring it home when it's going to be a year until they get the chance.
And you may
to
not,
bring it home.
Though, right? Like with Paul, we've seen he's had a number of slogans. I think he comes up with them.
Yes.
He pushes them out and they see what resonates. And then it's not like
you can finesse.
Different political parties, what they'll do is in campaigns, will focus group a slogan and then put it out.
Yeah.
I think what he's doing, and knowing him and the people around him, he puts out a slogan and sees how it works. Then you test it and you see how it goes and you keep putting money behind it and running advertisements. But he may have an entirely different message.
Yeah, that is actually absolutely true.
But it's his discipline and his work ethic right now that is running circles around anyone I've ever seen. Like, the guy was in Vancouver one day, Brampton the next, Montreal the next, doing announcements. Like, he is everywhere. Like, we always talk about...
And topical, too. Last week was all about Carthage. 100%
topical. It's
all about... You know, I'm going to go to a port, and I'm going to point to port, you know.
Yeah, it was almost an extension of procedure, parliamentary procedure, where a month ago, the Liberals said we're going to have this big auto theft summit in Ottawa, right? And the Conservatives are like, we're going to hijack that.
Yeah, we are. And well done. Like, they did a really good job.
He did three press conferences in three different provinces.
They had an opposition motion.
Yes.
Was basically laying
They owned that in the House of Commons.
What I really love, Michelle, this does get back to procedure. What I loved is, here's the thing with an opposition motion. It's very tricky to write it in the way to get the result you want. Because if you're the opposition party, you don't want the government to vote for your motion.
No, that's
you
a big
don't.
Failure.
That's bad.
You failed if they vote for your motion.
So you want to put have your preamble full of language about how, like, Justin Trudeau is personally sending out people to steal your cars. But then, at the bottom, you have three perfectly reasonable policy positions. So you have to combine the two. You make the government vote against the perfectly reasonable policy positions because, of course, they're not going to vote for the preamble part. So they have gotten very good at crafting motions that the government cannot possibly support, yet are entirely reasonable as far as what they're proposing.
Right.
And that is an art. It is an art that they have now managed to...
And it's fascinating to see that they've gotten to this level of...
I have been in opposition for a while.
They have been. And historically, they usually are, right?
Yeah.
But our party's rooted more so in the Reform Party than the PC Party.
That is probably
so
true.
We've lost, I think, a lot of the old...
The Reform Party used to do... They were very experimental in procedure. Like, they...
So maybe that's where they've gotten to this point, right?
Yeah, I think
where
it was because they were taking that outsider approach and they came to Ottawa and they were able to kind of just do really... I mean, the one I will always remember is, legend has it that every MP was given... a motion, a piece of paper with a motion that they would ask for unanimous consent for if they ever noticed that there weren't any Liberals in the House. And it happened one day, and the particular Conservative MP who stood up and asked for unanimous consent, it was a motion temporarily suspending the power to use time allocation. And it got unanimous consent because there were no Liberals in the House to object to it.
Oh, fascinating.
And because they pulled it out at the right time. Do you know what the Liberals had to do? They were in government at the time. They had to negotiate on bended knee to get the Conservatives to agree.
The Reform Party.
Yes, I'm sorry. To get the Reform Party to agree to roll that back, to reverse it.
So that's fascinating.
Because for like a week and a half, I think it was like a week and a half or 2 weeks, the government had no closure. They could not, those standing orders had been suspended.
Wow.
And it was because...
So that could be the root of where the Conservatives, Andrew Scheer, Pierre Poilievre, these guys are reformers.
Yeah.
That's where they come from.
Who knows? Maybe they have motions in their desks right now. I mean, I think the Liberals are now too smart to let that happen again. But,
right.
You know, that's how they did it, because they were told, if you ever notice that there's no Liberals to object, you're going to stand up and ask for unanimous consent for this motion.
Wow. Now, there's the biggest parliamentary procedure trick that I can think of, and maybe it's not even parliamentary procedure, maybe it's outside of it. It's prorogation.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you just shut down Parliament entirely. I've seen it happen a number of times. Typically, the first time I saw it, I think, was for the Olympics.
Because Canadians didn't want Parliament happening at the same time as the Olympics. It was like the weirdest rationale.
Nothing to do with Afghanistan.
No, not
detainees.
At all. Totally right.
I actually believe it was. I think the plan was always to, during that break, to... celebrate the Olympics. It was a national story, right?
The Olympics. Had it not followed the prorogation, it was not for the Olympics the previous year, that probably would have played out okay. But the problem was that it came after the original, more controversial prorogation that was to...
Oh, I'm getting my timeline mixed up.
No, the first was the first year and the second was the Olympics, because it started with the prorogation that was about the...
Save the government.
And it was the next year, like just a year
right,
though.
Right.
But this was the thing. And it was like, why are you doing this? This is just weird. It actually, I will always hold the Conservatives responsible for. They ruined prorogation because it's not actually supposed to be that controversial. You are supposed to be able to...
Well, I think saving your government is, and legitimately saving
fair,
it
fair.
When...
They felt they had to do it, but you then had this, the Liberals, they literally did not prorogue during their first term.
Right.
It was like a four-year term.
Right, when they should have.
They
typically
should have.
2 years is a
two
normal
years is
reset.
Totally normal.
Bring in a new speech, new bills.
I really wish we would get back to the point where prorogation every, at a midway point is giving a throne speech. Like, there's just, it kind of makes sense. It's like starting a new season. And because of the way, again, because of the way the House works, it is not that big a deal to bring back government legislation. As long as you, if you have a majority, you can just reintroduce it if you've got the consent. Private members' business, totally protected.
Right,
all private
get lost.
Is like frozen where it is. It comes back exactly. Like really all it is an excuse for a throne speech. It does give you, if you do the prorogation like a month out from when you're going to recall, that raises my eyebrows because I want to know why you don't want Parliament in session. I don't care if you want to prorogue and then a week later you come back. That's
right.
Fine.
You could do it days before.
Yeah,
you could do it the same day. Yeah.
Like it's, and that to me, and that was why when the Liberals did their prorogation in
after the Wee scandal, right? In 2020.
Yeah. Committees can't meet during prorogation.
It was 100% due to the Wee scandal.
Yeah. And that bugs me as a parliamentarian because I think committees should always be able to meet. Fine, prorogue, do, you know, go nuts, prorogue, but prorogue a week before, maybe 2 weeks before.
It's funny, the Conservatives, I believe, were around 41% in the polls then as well. Like, we were way up in the polls
and
then.
And then you won that majority government in 2021. It was great. Sorry. That hurt. That was really mean.
I called you a process nerd, and you hit me back with that.
I did. I came back. I'm really, really sorry.
Look, we could have won a majority. We were on the track. We'll go into that. Then COVID hit. So the Liberal NDP supply and confidence accord or arrangement or agreement. I don't know what the A stands for.
I think it's agreement, yeah. I never call it that. SACA. Somehow that became the acronym.
SACA. It's funny because that's the development that I they build houses where I come from. So SACA, if this breaks down, the agreement is the NDP support confidence motions of the government. And in return, the government works on
shared priorities.
Dental care, pharma care.
There's a couple of other ones.
I think $1 million to everyone's personal accounts.
Yes, exactly.
Something like that.
I haven't looked at the details.
Yeah,
oh, some changes to the Elections Act, which I think is probably one of the things that they're now apparently working on.
If SACA fails, if the NDP pull out, if they're not happy with PharmaCare, because I believe they've given a deadline,
March 1st. It's a new deadline.
Right.
I mean, who knows? Maybe they'll extend it again, but that
is just gave it this week, or last week. They're getting awfully close. It's hard for them to pull back. If it's not there, the agreement's dead, and what happens?
So nothing happens immediately. Look, the Liberals had a minority. They managed to make it through a minority without a supply and confidence deal. They would approach every piece of legislation on a case-by-case basis. So if they had a bill that they knew they could get the Bloc to support, they would go to the Bloc. I've almost come around to the notion that it's almost in the best interest of both the Liberals and the New Democrats if the deal maybe falls by the wayside, simply because they would still be able to work together on areas or on legislation where they have a common goal. It doesn't automatically bring down the government because, again, they have the Bloc Québécois is perfectly willing to step in and be a bargaining partner as well. And it also frees both the Liberals and the NDP from kind of being held to these parameters, which honestly, I don't think are working for the New Democrats as well as perhaps they would have hoped. But it doesn't seem to me like they're getting enough credit for getting the things done, like dental care, for example, that would make this worthwhile. Because the reality is that when the NDP hit the hustings in the next election, whenever it is, they've got to be, as they always say, running for government. They can't be saying, hey, don't you want to elect us to help the Liberals again? Because that is
That's
not a thing
so
people do.
That's what's so ridiculous. So the NDP have no desire to be in government from what I see. The provincial NDP, yes.
They win
government. But the federal NDP, they if they wanted to be in government now, they could have struck a deal with the Liberals or at least forced their hand to say, let's do a minority government like every other country does. But this federal NDP, to me, I don't think they understand their purpose.
Yeah, they have kind of hit an existential crisis. And I think actually part of that, ironically, was the success with dental care simply because the Liberals have embraced that. Like, the Liberals love dental care. They are all about getting out there and taking credit for it, which means the New Democrats, it sounds a little hard to believe when Singh comes out and is like, and we forced them to bring in dental care. It's like they look delighted to be bringing in dental care.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally understand the calculations the New Democrats made. I get it was a high-risk move. It could have worked out differently for them. I think from their perspective politically, they would lose nothing backing away now. They can still vote for, they can still vote to support the government on areas they want. They would just have the freedom to not do it if they didn't support something.
Right. And given the, you know, the NDP, again, not motivated to take government. Mm. The polls are bad for them, just like they are for the Liberals.
They're not great, no.
And so why not just, they'll keep this parliament alive until it dies its natural death.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the unfortunate thing from the New Democrat perspective is they sold this to their members as being, this is how we'll get things done. I'm just not sure they have enough things that they have on that list that they can go to and say, hey, New Democrats, look at all this stuff we made the Liberals do. And they got a couple, but they don't have enough quite yet. So yeah, it becomes tricky.
I think Jagmeet Singh is an incredibly weak leader. And if they had a Jack Layton type, and I know that's a once in a generation leader, they could be competing for government right now. Like a lot of that vote, that blue collar middle class vote that Poilievre is eating up, could or maybe historically should be NDP.
Sometimes you see them, they're trying to dip over to that. I mean, remember when they supported the Conservatives that one time on the carbon tax because they saw it as being a way to sort of, but the Conservatives own the carbon tax issue now, so the NDP can't really buy into that. Yeah, I personally have always thought Jagmeet Singh should have stuck it out in Ontario. He is so good at things that are provincial responsibility.
That's where his interests are. That's what he wants to do.
And there's nothing wrong with that. He probably, if he'd held out, he would probably have become New Democrat leader in Ontario. And he would probably have a pretty good shot at becoming premier.
Right.
But yeah, I'm sure.
That's interesting. I never thought of that if he had taken that path instead. Because I do, I think he is a, I think the NDP is a party that's just drifting.
They do seem to have kind of lost their purpose. And it is, I mean, it's incredibly awkward. Every time Jagmeet Singh wants to have a press conference to, you know, denounce the Liberals for something, the first question obviously is, so are you going to stop supporting them?
Right.
And then his answer is like, well, I don't know, maybe, blah, blah, blah.
That's what some,
it's not a good answer.
He's not, he doesn't look sincere or authentic when he comes out and hammers the Liberals about how terrible they are.
And then it's,
they're in government because of him.
I know. It is an unworkable position. And I think that they didn't think it through.
That's why it's one of those things where if you're going to make a deal for government.
Yeah.
Be there.
Be a minister.
And be a part of it. Right. Like at least be at the decision-making table, not say I want these two, three or four policy things. I want to govern on these hundreds of issues we're dealing with. But also then you have to take responsibility though. And I don't think the NDP or the federal NDP have that mindset.
They've never been in government. They have no idea.
And they've never been close, right?
No,
like I know
no,
11,
they really haven't. I mean, there was at the start of 2015, the race was between Mulcair and Harper, and there was actual talk about what a Mulcair administration might look like. But even then, it was very nebulous.
And he wasn't a normal New Democrat, right?
No, he wasn't. He really wasn't. And that was his whole thing.
Easily could have been a Liberal or a Conservative.
Running to become prime minister.
Yeah.
Remember, that was his whole thing? They were all running to become prime minister. So I'm sure we'll hear Singh say exactly the same thing again. But yeah, it does. Honestly, in general, I think that not only would the loss of the supply and confidence deal not doom us to an immediate election, it would probably work out in everyone's best interest for at least the next 6 to 9 months.
Right.
And then, you know, everyone can kind of figure out what they want to do from there. But yeah, I think the Liberals got used to operating on a case-by-case basis when they didn't have a deal. It kind of, they weren't able to do everything they wanted, but they can't do that now. And the NDP, I think, have really given up a lot of credibility and would probably do better if they weren't in this deal right now.
Right, right. So you're, I think, the only journalist that's really focused on process and procedure. Do you feel that, like, are there any other journalists that cover this at this level? Like, is there anyone else out
there? Dale Smith watches what's going on in the House of Commons. I mean, there are others. Here's the thing, and this is what I was trying to get to earlier. A lot of what happens that becomes consequential in terms of procedural maneuvers, it isn't immediate. It's like you notice one thing, and then you notice the next day another thing, and you notice a trend line, and then 2 weeks later, you have like a standoff in the House of Commons, and suddenly everyone's covering it.
Right.
You see it coming days before. You see, if you know what to look for, you can see it coming beforehand. But yeah, in general, the only time it becomes kind of headline news is a good example being when, for example, the Conservatives say they're going to filibuster and keep MPs voting
right,
for weeks.
Right.
That's great TV for
them. And then you have journalists covering for the first time trying to explain what a filibuster is.
Exactly.
And trying to learn
exactly.
themselves as
and,
telling the story.
You know, and stuff like that, I think, does get the attention. But yeah, before that, it's seen as being sort of too incremental. And yeah, it's process nerdery. I mean, I take right. process nerd as a badge of honor, but not everyone necessarily sees it that way.
Well, awesome. This was so much fun. Great catching up with you, Katie, and talking through process and procedure. It's something that really got me, like when I first really got interested in politics, it was watching CPAC and seeing the stuff.
Routine
and playing,
proceedings is where all the good stuff happens.
Playing House of Cards in my mind.
Yeah.
Right? So this was great. So thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, thanks so much for listening to another episode of On Background. It was another great chat with Katie. Haven't talked to her in a very long time. So it was fun to reminisce and talk about parliamentary procedure. Please don't forget to subscribe, like, and share this podcast. And we will see you next week for another episode of On Background.